You are listening to Sid Weighs In, where Tuck School business professor, associate dean for executive education, and an expert on strategy and leadership, Sidney Finkelstein, shares his views on what leaders are doing, why they are doing it, and whether it makes sense for them and for you.
This is Sidney Finkelstein with another edition of Sid Weighs In, where I talk about one of my recent BBC columns in the form of a podcast, and I do it with a terrific guest host, and today the guest host is Ashley Hovey. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing very well today. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am currently at the Tuck School of Business up in Hanover, New Hampshire. It is in the single digits today, which is above where it has been all week.
By the way, it's summertime now for everyone listening.
Basically, it's been pretty brutal. My background is all on the West Coast, working in advertising and tech for the Nielsen Company. And I'm going to be actually moving to London very shortly here, so I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, I love London. I spent a year there. I went to the London School of Economics.
Oh, great.
And it was terrific. But, you know, when I was there, it was the era of really lousy food.
Actually, there's a great fish and chips place right around the corner from LSE.
Which
like one of the best ones it's one of the best ones in the city.
All right.
Oh, of course I'm going to blank on the name.
You'll have to tell me
but
later because
yes,
if
I
you
will.
Mention it now with the millions of people listening to this podcast, we'll have to get some advertising money out of them.
That's true. We should maybe tell them before we...
I mean, this is a business school after all.
Yeah. It's
so
things, if we've learned anything.
So what are you up to these days?
Actually, funnily enough, I just got off the phone with my boss at British Telecom, and we've been talking about going through the visa process as I'm an American, and just a couple of things, what am I going to work on going forward? And, you know, I loved it because I decided to join because he is so hands-off, and I really work well with someone who lets me have a lot of independence, and you know, I'm excited to talk about this topic today because, you know, I got pretty fired up about this. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say.
So you like the idea that he's really hands-off.
Yeah, I am anti-micromanagement.
And I'm about to tell you why I think micromanagement is actually one of the great hidden skills of leaders.
Yes.
That's freaky. Okay, yeah. Well, let's start.
Okay.
The paradox of micromanagement. What do Steve Jobs, Mickey Drexler, and Jeff Bezos all have in common? They are all builders of giant brands, from Apple to J.Crew to Amazon, certainly. But there's something else you might not realize they have in common, and it's directly related to their success. Each is, or was, an unmitigated, unapologetic micromanager. What gives? How could the bane of many of our performance reviews actually be a good thing? I can't tell you how many leadership experts have listed micromanagement as public enemy number one. But when strategically applied, it can be a powerful tool, not only to get things done, but to develop talent as well. Why would you micromanage anyways? Well, here's a bad answer, because you don't trust anyone else to do his or her job as well as you could. A better answer? Because you're so passionate about what you're doing that you're always striving to make it better. How about the best answer? Because you have a vision for what your business should look like, and you are prepared to back up that vision with action. The modern executive is taught, in business schools and in many jobs, that to manage people effectively is to delegate and then get out of the way. I teach our MBA students at the Tuck School. I teach you, Ashley. Well, I don't know if I did. I teach our students much of the same thing, except for one caveat. Delegating is only step one. It's not delegate and forget. It's got to be delegate and be intimately involved with what happens next. You don't want to and can't do everyone else's job for them. But why would you walk away, as so many managers do? When you have deep passion for your business, for your job, you also have a responsibility to be involved with how your vision is executed. You'll likely step on some toes along the way, and you may go too far on occasion. But which is worse, occasionally butting in on a subordinate's work to make a point or not providing real-time feedback to help that subordinate grow and excel? The dichotomy between delegation and micromanagement, I think, is false and misleading. It's not one or the other. It's actually both. And if that doesn't sound so easy to do, well, guess what? Welcome to the big leagues of leadership. It ain't that easy. Being able to handle and indeed thrive by doing two opposing things at once is a hallmark of great leaders. Such ambidextrous leaders intensely execute today's game plan while sowing the seeds for what comes next. They're deeply analytical at the same time as they're looking for creative solutions to business challenges. And they're hands-on delegators. It's a paradox only for the tired and the timid. All right, now the fine print. Micromanagers must be selective. You can't delve into details of everything, and in fact, superstar micromanagers don't. Mickey Drexler might interview every single corporate hire and more at the $2 billion-plus J.Crew, but he lets other leaders manage the IT function, for example. Steve Jobs was intimately involved with each product the company designed and was even famously involved in designing the glass stairs at the Apple stores. But financial and operational issues were delegated to second-in-command and current Apple CEO Tim Cook. Even Jeff Immelt, CEO of blue-chip industrial conglomerate General Electric, is a selective micromanager. For him, intimately knowing the top 500 executives in the company, what their performance and their potential looks like, and what they need to develop further are always at the top of his agenda. That's not a bad role model for any manager at any level, come to think of it. One key, micromanagers must be experts. What could be worse than a manager immersed in the details who really doesn't know his stuff? Sam Walton spent most of his time flying in his little airplane to visit stores, deepening his knowledge as he went. When he had something to say, there was deep credibility behind it. Now, there's a natural limit to when micromanagement makes sense. Once a job or a company becomes too complex or too big, it becomes that much harder to gain the visibility and time you need to stay expert. This is a real danger zone for would-be micromanagers. You just don't have enough time in the day or energy in the belly to keep up the pace that is necessary. Either you embrace the principle of selective micromanagement or you go down trying to do what can't be done. Finally, it takes a strong and trusted team to be a micromanager. Could Steve Jobs have spent weeks with the iPhone design team if there was no one else to mind the store? If not for Tim Cook, perhaps the legend of Steve Jobs would not have turned out quite so well. The good news is that the best micromanagers are often the best talent developers. Their attention to detail, their intimate knowledge of the business, and their deep involvement in what's actually going on enables more, not less, delegation. Their position in the center of the work creates an opportunity for micromanagers to challenge subordinates with big assignments precisely because they're informed. Delegating big does not carry the same degree of risk that it might for the typical manager. As a result, it makes it possible to delegate big. And so, the final paradox of the micromanager is this. Micromanagers actually help other people get better at what they do.
You know, Sid, I'm really struggling with this last sentence. You talk about it's important to get real-time feedback. You talk about it's important having the team buying into this vision. But how do you get people to buy in when the response to this word is so negative? And when you know, for example, that going to work for someone means that they are going to micromanage you. How do you convince them to do that?
Yeah, you know, we have a problem with wording, and micromanagement, as I said, is a dirty word. But I think the behaviors that I'm describing as effective micromanagement, you don't have to label them with anything because they involve two or three things. And remember, the first thing was deep delegation. I mean, if you're working for your new boss or whoever it happens to be, he or she is going to give you a big job that's going to push you, that's going to challenge you. But they're not going to leave you alone and kind of hope that it all works out. In fact, they're going to be heavily involved. You know what it reminds me of, actually? A bunch of your classmates have come from Teach for America, which is, you know, a fantastic idea where young, smart college grads spend a couple of years typically in an inner city school as a teacher. They're thrown in the deep end, and they have no experience in teaching. And the data indicate that it's not always such a great experience for a lot of those folks. But the ones where it works is where the principal of the school doesn't just throw you in and kind of leave you alone. They're involved. They're coaching. They're paying attention. So you've got a lot of deep learning, but it's not like you're going there on your own without any involvement from a very passionate, deeply engaged principal. I don't know if it's an exactly direct analogy, but it strikes me that there's something to it.
So then would you argue that someone who is an expert, right, that is micromanaging because they have this expertise, that's not just coaching? I mean, micromanagement implies that they're actually going to do your work. I mean, Is that where the disconnect is for me? Because I don't want to go to a job where my boss comes in and says, actually, I redid your whole presentation.
Right,
I don't want that. Nobody wants that.
You
that's not pushing.
So you know, that would be to me maybe a classic fear around what micromanagers are going to do. If your boss is doing your work, I guess I'm not really calling that micromanagement. I'm saying your boss is with you. He wants to know, or she wants to know what you're doing. And not just every week. It could be every day she'll show up. She'll poke around. She might take something that you've done and make adjustments to it, whether you ask her for feedback or not. So it's pushing the envelope. But I don't think it's completely redoing your work. It's seeing what you can do and then continually pushing you to go a little further and a little further and not hesitating to kind of step in and get involved. So in a sense, if you look at that as feedback, you got to be really open to that type of feedback. And maybe it's not for everyone. But I have seen, and I'm looking at this in some new research that I'm doing, I have seen the people that work for people, for leaders that combine deep delegation with this type of selective micromanagement. They become stars. It's a fast track to deep knowledge and growth as a would-be and potential leader.
So I need to get back on the phone and make sure that my future boss is as invested as these selective micromanagers you're talking about.
This is a great word. You're looking for investment and you're looking for coaching and you're looking for it at a deep level. You want to be a partner. Maybe that's what the word should really be. You want to be a partner with your boss and she's got to be a partner with you as well.
All right, John, if you're listening, I'm calling you.
See you later, Ashley.
Bye.
This has been Sid Wazin. If you would like to comment on this podcast, follow Professor Finkelstein on Twitter @SidFinkelstein, #SidWazin. Thank you for listening.